Christensen, he's applied for one of these Psi Fellow positions, which we'll have next year, and he'll be around actually for today and tomorrow, so you'll see him like at lunch. And he's in particle physics, so that's where what his research is in. Okay, so just to continue on, we stopped in the middle of this calculation of the Cooper pair problem, which is Cooper's idea that if you add two electrons in the presence of a filled Fermi sea and an attractive interaction, then, well, I mean, Cooper's idea was to see what happens. The answer is that you get some kind of a bound state. So we'll just continue on with that. I just put this into the Schrodinger equation in the presence of this interaction, and we had found that these G's that we're looking for obey this type of And just to remind you about what all these little pieces mean, we've modeled the attractive interaction between the two electrons by saying that there's a energy of attraction minus V if the electrons are within some cutoff of the Fermi energy. So in particular, I've written here a prime over the sum, which means that this is some special kind of sum. Sum over prime means that absolute value of K is greater than KF, and H bar squared K squared over 2m is less than EF plus this cutoff. I guess that's, these are, well, let's write it this way. That if you had a sum over k with the prime, that meant that you're only summing over k's greater than the Fermi wave vector, but for states whose energies are between the Fermi energy and the Fermi energy plus the cutoff. Okay, is that all clear? Holger. The cutoff, some physical mechanism which gives rise to the attractive interaction in the first place. Actually, we'll do that. We'll look at that in a few minutes. Okay. So why would you ever have that? I mean, you first have to ask yourself the question, why would you ever have an attractive interaction between electrons? That's related. So what this equation says then is that G of K is equal to this thing. Times V over H bar squared K squared over M minus E minus 2EF. Just rearranging it. And then if you operate on both sides with over L cubes, in other words, sum both sides over K, then basically you have this sum on both sides of the equation, you can just cancel out. And this leaves you with 1 is equal to 1. Okay, so this is the equation basically for your bound state energy. Everybody happy with that? Okay. And so now we just want to evaluate this, and we do that by turning the sum into an integral. Okay, so we're going to express this as an energy integral that's going to go from 0 to the cutoff for energies that are going from EF to the cutoff. And then this is the density of states, is because remember the density of states at around the Fermi energy for small excursions from the Fermi energy is basically a constant. And the idea is that this cutoff, whatever it is, well, this works if the cutoff is small compared to the Fermi energy, so that this integral is going over a range which is such that n doesn't change very much. So then the equation for the bound state energy becomes 1 is n of 0 integral from 0 to omega c v over 2c minus E dx. Is that okay? And this is just a logarithm. Of 2 omega C minus E over minus E, which is the same as, so that's just a logarithm. And so basically, log and so you can solve that and get that E minus 2 omega C equals E times E to the 2 over N of 0 V. And you can solve that and get that E is equal to 2 omega C over 1 plus minus 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 E to the 2 over N of 0 V, which is approximately minus 2 omega C E to the minus 2 over N of 0 V. Okay. Yeah.
So are you trying to say that you are choosing the cutoff such that the n is close to n zero?
Okay, so the cutoff is small compared to the Fermi energy. Okay. And where did I use that? I didn't actually use that. Yeah, so up here I said, yeah. So up here I said the cutoff is small enough so that the density of states doesn't vary very much between the Fermi energy and the Fermi energy plus the cutoff. That was one thing that I assumed. And the other thing is that I assumed is that the attractive interaction V is much smaller than the Fermi energy. Or if you like, remember the density of states at the Fermi energy is something like 1 over the Fermi energy. And so as long as your interaction, your attractive interaction is weak. And in fact, the scale of energies here is basically V is less than omega C is less than EF. That's the scale. Yeah.
Does it show that the Cooper pairs are behaving like bosons?
No, that doesn't show that. Does it? No. But I mean, I know what you mean. This looks like a, yeah. But this, remember, this number here is large compared to 1. Because the whole point is that V is small. N of 0 V is small. And so this is the exponential of a very large number. So the 1 is irrelevant in this expression, unless you're in what people would call the very strong coupling limit, which is to say that V was very large, which you're, you know, the assumption is you're not. So that's probably not connected to a Bose function. But what it is it's a negative number, which is small, but non-zero, even for infinitesimal attractive interaction. So the observations are, 1, is that if you have arbitrarily small attractive interaction, you get a bound state. Observation number 2 would be that if you looked at, so what is this? This is like the two-body problem with the weak attractive interaction, but in the presence of a filled Fermi C. Okay. If you got rid of the filled Fermi C, then you would be doing the problem of two particles interacting with a weak attractive potential in three dimensions. Okay? So the two-body problem which would correspond to if you like EF equals 0, N of C would go like the square root of the energy, just free particles. We know that problem doesn't have a bound state for in three dimensions for small attractive interactions. You have to crank up the interaction to a certain level before it will have a bound state. Yeah, because we put in a minus sign into the, potential. It is attractive. Yeah, yeah. And if he's the other way, this doesn't happen either. Right. Not surprisingly. The other thing to notice is that it's not analytic. In V. So it turns on in some non-analytic way, which means that it's hard to get out of sort of standard perturbation theory. And the other observation that I'd like to make is that we've chosen a simple spatially symmetric form for the attractive potential. For the potential, and hence for psi of R1 and R2 for the wave function. And that has a number of consequences. First of all, it means that the spin wave function that goes along with it has to be a singlet, anti-symmetric in spin. Yeah, Monty.
Is the B in the denominator or the numerator?
It's in the denominator. It's N of 0 V goes together.
So when you're saying that the bound state is even for all arbitrary small V, doesn't the state, isn't the state like more bound?
No, it's less bound the smaller the V.
Energy more negative than V is smaller.
Now, as V gets smaller,
there's a minus.
So it's 2 over some very small number. So it's e to the minus nothing. Or sorry, it's e to the minus a huge number, or 1 over nothing. And so it really is, you know, very tenuously bound for small v. Okay. Nevertheless, it's bound, and it just pops right out of this because when v is small, this is a huge number, which then comes up and becomes small, and so forth and so on. So, yeah. So I'm sorry about the notation. So we choose for the potential and for psi, and this implies spin. This implies a spin singlet. That's one thing. Okay. But the other point that I would make is that we didn't have to choose such a nice spherically symmetric potential. You can actually choose potentials that are, for the pair wave function, anisotropic, that have some angular dependence that looks like a higher angular momentum state. And then the wave function that you get will reflect that fact. And in fact, you could sort of go through this type of a calculation where the pairing wave function had P wave. Or in other words, instead of this is angular momentum zero, if you like, for this fully symmetric solution. But you could have, for some potential, you could have a bound state that has angular momentum one or angular momentum two. So angular momentum two would be analogous to what you have when you have a D wave superconductor. Again, then, the spin state for the pair has to be singlet because L equals 2 is symmetric under interchange of the two. But if you had an angular momentum 1 bound state, which is P wave, then the spin state that goes along with it would have to be a spin triplet state, which is symmetric under interchange of the spins. And that would then imply interesting properties. Bruno, yeah?
What kind of interactions can
realize? Well, I mean, I guess the way that I think of it is that the thing about the spatially symmetric thing, which tends to, although it doesn't have to be pretty well peak when they're close to each other, doesn't work so well if you have a hard core. So if instead of electrons, you were working with helium-3 atoms, then they don't actually like to, unless it's very, very large, they don't actually like to be in a L equals 0 state. They have to avoid each other's core. The thing about L equals 1 and higher is that it gives you nodes at R1 equals R2. So those higher angular momentum states allow the two fermions to stay away from each other. Okay, but you might have, I mean, if you think of atoms, what have you got? You've got a hard repulsive core, and you've got a long distance attractive Van der Waals type of interaction. And so this type of P-wave bound state can work quite well for that. Okay, and that's what happens, as it turns out, in helium-3. Now, you might say, what about D-wave? Well, if you look at the orbital structure of the electrons in the high TC cuprates, which are D-wave, I mean, they're actually in D orbitals. And so you can say on the basis of that, it might not, you can imagine that they would pair in a D relative D state. But actually, I can motivate this more convincingly if I develop the Hubbard model, the extended, or the TJ model, or the extended Hubbard model, and things like that that do give rise to D wave superconductivity. We'll hopefully do a little bit of that before the end of the week. Okay, so I'll give you some examples for electrons. Yes, Solomon. In a power series in 1 over V?
Yeah.
In 1 over V you could, but V is small, so it's not 1 over V is not a small parameter. It's not analytic in V, yeah. Yeah, because this is e to the minus 2 over V, over n 0 V. So V is in the denominator. It's a non-analytic function. It's like e to the minus 1 over x. Okay? You can't expand that as a power series in x. Okay. Yeah.
One of the kind of interactions that can give rise to that field is like we have the electrons that interact through a phonon, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What sort of other kinds of potential interactions can create the interaction between the two fermions of that effect?
Well, okay, so the kind of interaction that comes up in high TC is a sort of like a spin or an attractive nearest neighbor interaction, either one of those. And that can give rise to actually either D or S, depending on the details of, like how the density of electrons and stuff like that.
So. And for common BCS superconductors, is this one?
For conventional superconductors, it's always been S wave, and it's always been phonons. Okay, so until you got the oxide cuprate, copper oxide superconductors, I think it was always the phonon mechanism. Yeah.
The two electrons, do they have to be? They don't have to be neighbors to each other, right?
Well, this is an artificial model, right? This is an artificial model where you're saying, let's say, I mean, we haven't solved the problem yet. This is very hokey because, look, you've got a filled Fermi C, and then you add two electrons, and they end up having a negative energy with respect to 2EF. So that's not physical, because they can't actually do that, right? So this isn't an internally consistent solution. So let's go on. But the significance of Cooper's observation is simply that to indicate that there's, you know, potentially some kind of instability in this system. That if you have an attractive interaction between electrons, then they might want to form these kinds of pair states. They can't do it, as I just said, in a consistent way, just by having two of them interacting with a Fermi, in the presence of a filled Fermi sea. But so the question is, how can you build up a proper many-body wave function that reflects this tendency? But first, let me just do the origin of the attractive interaction. And that is phonons. And the picture, just to put it in a nutshell, or maybe it looks more like a collection of... If these are your ions, they should normally line up in straight lines and not be wandering all over the place the way that I'm drawing them. But the idea is, these are all plus. And so forth. And the idea is that why are these ions in the middle all like that? It's because some electron just went whizzing through, and it pulled together the positive ions in its wake. Okay? So eventually it keeps going, and these guys will go back to where they should be. But the point is that the electron's very light and fast, and the ions are very heavy and slow. And so if another electron comes along, it can get sucked into this wake, and these two guys can just go along, taking advantage of the fact that the guy in the front has sort of given you this region of excess positive charge. That's a very much hand-waving description of what happens. And the other point that I'd like to make about this is that because, as I said, the electrons are fast, light and fast, and the ions are heavy and slow, these electrons don't have to be very close to each other in order to take advantage of this lattice distortion. They can stay fairly far apart. And that's important because really the electrons repel each other, as we all know. Okay? And that effect of the fact that these guys are moving fast, this thing's moving slow, and that they can stay apart is called retardation. Okay? So basically what the electrons see, and we're doing this with no equations at all, the electrons see the effect of their Coulomb interaction with each other and also the effect of their interaction with the distortion in the positive ion background. And if they're moving the right way, the direct Coulomb interaction is unimportant compared to the indirect attractive interaction via the polarization of the lattice. Okay? And I should say that there are equations to go with all these words. But if we had a... Yeah, and that's actually what's built in. There's an assumption that's built in that these guys are figuring out how to do this. Okay? Yeah, that's exactly right. We haven't mentioned phonons before. I don't think maybe the word came up once. But the phonon Hamiltonian looks something like this, sum over wave vectors and polarizations, omega q. Actually, let's get rid of the polarizations just to make it into a simpler model. So these are Bose operators. The electron-phonon interaction can be written in different ways. I'll write it in a particular way that Cattell writes it in his quantum theory of solids. I think this is something like the phonon momentum or something like that. The momentum of the, yeah.
What did you write there? Bose?
These are Bose operators, yeah. So they obey commutation relations, unlike the fermion operators, which is what we've done. So basically what happens is that the electron scatters, the electron destroys a phonon with wave vector q. Did I get this backwards? Yeah. Yeah, you destroy K and Q and you get, it absorbs a phonon with wave vector Q and scatters from K to K plus Q. Or vice versa, it emits a phonon with wave vector minus Q and scatters from K to K plus Q. Okay. So this thing here involves product of three operators. And the effective interaction, I think this is going to be a tutorial problem?
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys are going to work this out, which is why I'm not actually going through any details. But the effective interaction looks something like this. This is the effective electron-electron interaction. That either an electron with wave vector k comes in, emits a phonon with momentum minus q, which is then absorbed, and this is minus k. So now we're looking at the interaction which couples paired states, k minus k paired states. It makes the writing, the diagrams easier. That doesn't really, but. And so this guy goes off with minus k, minus q. This thing went off with k plus q. Because he emitted a phonon with minus q. So that's one diagram that you can have. And the other diagram is sort of like reverses the time at which these two things happen. So and then this guy here with k comes along and absorbs that and goes off with k plus q. So there's two ways of writing the effective interaction depending on what the intermediate state is. And this is like in second order perturbation theory, as you can see, because it's got two of these vertices. And when you add it all up, you get an effective interaction as a function of the phonon which is exchanged, its momentum. You get something that looks like that, if you can read it. Okay, so that's the result of a calculation which you'll do. And what you can see about this is, of course, the phonon frequencies are all positive, but if these two states are close in energy compared to the phonon frequency, then this is attractive. And if they're far apart in energy compared to the phonon energy, then it's repulsive. Okay? So for small energy transfer, it's attractive. Yeah.
So the difference between those two diagrams is just the direction of the photon?
Well, the time at which one, which electron emits first, the minus K or the plus K, emits or absorbs a phonon first. But in each case, this is emitting a phonon with wave vector Q. This is emitting a phonon with wave vector minus Q. But in this case, this guy is first, and this one absorbs it. In this case, this one emits it, and this one absorbs it. Okay, I mean, there's a certain amount of bookkeeping that goes in. But the important thing is this is attractive. And it's this idea which motivated BCS to approximate the effect of phonon-mediated interaction by the one that we've been using, which says, and this is sort of like then the BCS interaction. That V effective is equal to minus V over L cubed or zero, depending on whether it's like this, something. This is actually a further approximation. Actually, here it was only the difference that had to be less than the phonon frequency. Here, it's basically saying you only consider states that are within a phonon frequency of EF. That's artificial, vastly simplifies the calculation. Okay, so this is like a model interaction. Okay, so now the question is, what did BCS do? Yeah?
So the conditions are there. For both of them, it's non-zero, right? And zero otherwise.
If both of these, this is
part of the process.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's not or, it's and. So, yeah.
So what's that dq in electron-phonon interaction? Block d, yes.
Well, it's like... it's your coupling constant. It's like how much do the electrons care if the ions have moved together or apart. Actually, that's basically. You might wonder how it depends on Q. Okay, actually, you don't have to worry about it because it's the phonons that we're talking about here are just sort of arbitrary phonons, and you probably could just treat this as a constant. And in fact, you know, when you come right down to it, the way you treat it is like this. And so all the real phonon details disappear except for this. It's going to be some number. It's going to determine the scale of the gap or the transition temperature. That's what it comes down to. And there's a lot swept under the rug here, or swept into the, but nothing bad. Okay. So now let's go on to, so we, so the real problem, as we know, is you put in a large number of electrons subject to this attractive interaction, and they become superconducting. So the way that BCS did this is, instead of adding a pair, to a filled Fermi C, that's Fermi C, you just add pairs to the vacuum, and you build up your state pair by pair. Okay, so add pairs . So you do things like this, C dagger, K up, C dagger, minus K down, operating on the vacuum, okay? But that's not exactly what you do, and you can just do this. Actually, if you did this for all Ks whose magnitude was less than KF, if you did exactly this, you could just make a filled Fermi C. Because all you're doing is adding up, K up minus K down. It's just like the order that you're adding them in. You can just construct the filled Fermi C just by doing that. So that's not going to get you superconductivity. So what BCS did was equivalent to this. Like that. Who was first? Joel?
This here, we have, instead of adding pairs, we add pairs. What's the difference between this two?
To the vacuum. Just use that as an excuse to defining what zero means. Zero means no electrons. Okay? So if you did this, that's a filled Fermi C. But what BCS did was this, okay, which is different from a filled Fermi C, so you either add nothing or you add a pair, time reverse pair, K minus K pair. Okay. So, and these U's and V's are to be determined. Okay. So you can think of this as a variational wave function. For the UKs and the VKs. And so this one here corresponds to VK equals 1 for K less than KF, and UK equals 0 in that case, and the opposite for K greater than KF. What they did. Now, we're not actually going to do the calculation this way. We're going to do the calculation in a way that's similar to the way we did Hartree-Fock, but it's useful to just look at the wave functions they wrote down to.
I don't understand what VK or UK are.
They're just complex numbers,
right.
Okay, which are variational parameters. And what you'd like to do is you'd like to say, let's treat the problem of the Hamiltonian, which is equal to the kinetic energy of the electrons plus this attractive interaction of that form, and find the set of U's and V's that give me the best ground state energy, and then look at the character, analyze the character of that ground state wave function, and see if it has any special interesting properties. Like, for instance, carries a supercurrent, has an energy gap,
right,
all, so forth and so on.
But I could have chosen so many different answers. Why is
it? Oh, because we know that these pairs like to take advantage of the attractive interaction. Or I even made this argument, this flimsy argument in the first lecture on superconductivity, where I said, well, look, you know, there's not a lot of phase space for a pair of electrons to scatter unless their total momentum is zero, in which case they can scatter any way they want. So that's what this does. This is mixing together all of those K minus K states, which all mix. And they're all mixed by the attractive interaction. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay. Actually, one reason I wrote down this state is because there's an obvious pathology. Well, not pathology. It's not very satisfying to write down a state where the number of electrons is so indefinite. Okay, and a lot of people have been inhibited in their understanding or confidence in the theory of superconductivity by the fact that this is a state which has an indefinite number of electrons. And Tony Leggett, for instance, actually, first time I ever showed this to Bill Unruh, he said, that can't be. You can't. Okay, so. Yeah, and I guess it's the same kind of thing, because there you've got a reservoir, you've got a chemical potential, and here you do too when you come right down to it. So if you have your superconductor and it's connected to a wire, which makes it much easier to do experiments, then you can say, oh, this isn't so bad. On the other hand, if you just have this chunk of superconductor, you can do lots of experiments on a chunk of superconductor which isn't connected to anything. Then you have to wonder, what good is this wave function? But we all know that's not right. But it's always pointed out that you can... You can work with a definite number of electrons if you just simply write. You can use this type of wave function if you integrate over all possible phases of V with this factor out in front, which gives you something only if you get n powers of the creation operator. This picks out all the terms that correspond to n over 2 pairs. Okay, so it's possible by linearly superimposing these wave functions with different phases to generate fixed n. Okay. That's an in principle possible thing, which I think I've never seen anyone actually do that.
But
I can't really read the exponent.
Phi. What is it? Actually, it's phi.
Phi.
Okay. E phi. Sorry, it's e to the I phi. I'm sorry. I was thinking. Just phi. Phi. Just phi. And so you pick up factors of 5 for every pair. Okay, so anyway. So what? Yeah, Bruno. Pretty much. Yeah, yeah. Fermi surface is going to disappear. The way that electrons go in, real electrons go in, is not going to have that type of distribution. But we can actually go ahead and calculate everything that happens for this wave function.
Is that should both of those be equation operators?
Yes. Sorry. Okay, so what's the problem that we're trying to solve? We're trying to solve the problem of h equals h naught plus h1, where h naught is sum over k and alpha epsilon of k minus mu c dagger k alpha c k alpha, and h1 is equal to minus 1 over 2n. I'm going to put in the prime here. Actually putting in more terms than we need, but the idea is that this is some attractive interaction that satisfies this rule that it only acts within when these objects have kinetic energies that are within omega to pi of the Fermi energy. Okay, so what you should do in principle is take this wave function, calculate the expectation value of this Hamiltonian, and then minimize that with respect to the U's and the V's, and see how good a ground state you can get. What we're going to do is a little bit different. We're going to do Hartree-Fock the way that we introduced it back at the beginning, which is to say we're going to work with a variational probability distribution that's expressed in terms of a variational Hamiltonian, and then use that, minimize with respect to the parameters in the variational Hamiltonian to again, get the best variational Hamiltonian we can get, and so forth at the level of Hartree-Fock. So this is equivalent to I'm trying to say that the variational problem is equivalent to considering a variational Hamiltonian, which we'll write as sum over k and alpha, some variational single particle energies minus alpha, plus, and remember, our variational Hamiltonian has to be one that we know how to solve exactly, which pretty much limits us to quadratic Hamiltonians. So the other part of this Hamiltonian, which we haven't seen before, will look like this. So basically, we're going to use this to define a probability distribution, which is the probability distribution for a quadratic Hamiltonian. and then adjust the parameters in this to give us the lowest expectation value, actually, of the free energy associated with H0 plus H1. We can do the nice thing about doing it this way is you can do the whole finite temperature thing right off the top. Okay? And so these are our variational parameters, these deltas and these epsilons. Okay? And in order to do that, the first thing that we have to do is solve this problem exactly. And that we can do. Okay, have you seen the solution to this? Yes, no? Okay, so we should do that. That's a new piece of. So this is a quadratic in the fermions that involves terms that create and destroy pairs. So you solve this by defining new fermion operators. Let's call them gamma. Which mix creation and electron creation and destruction operators. Okay, and this is compatible with the fact that this doesn't conserve the number of these guys. And we need something for minus k down, which is, we'll call this uk prime, c minus k down plus VK prime C dagger K up. Why have I written it this way? These are the two operators that involve creating a K up and destroying a minus K down. So if you like these, I could invert this relation to get the C's in terms of the gammas. Because there's two equations in those two operators. I've done it right. Yes. Okay. So the condition that these are fermion operators. Requires, so that's, you just need this equation to implement this condition, this K up. And so then this requires that, I mean, you can just substitute this in, but this requires that so when you put in this with its adjoint and do the commutators, you get two U's, the term with two U's in terms of two V's. And this exactly the same thing applies to the primed U's and V's. I guess we're getting late. Actually, we're going to get into, yeah, algebra, so let's... If you choose the U's and V's correctly, that's the idea. Yeah. Yeah, there will be more conditions to be satisfied by the U's and the V's than this, though. Okay. And that's exactly what we want to calculate. I mean, in order to be eigen operators, the U's and the V's will have to be connected to the epsilons and the deltas, okay, in order to be the right eigen operators. So, okay, so we'll do that next time. I think this is as good a place as any to stop. Any other questions? Okay. So, yeah.
How does that mechanism work? How does it pick out only the
weights? Well, if you look at so when you multiply this out,
right,
you're going to get a certain number of U's and a certain number of V's. Every V carries with it two creation operators.
Yeah.
Okay. So if in order to cancel out this phase, you need to have n over 2 of the V's,
right,
because that gives you n over 2 of the I phi's.
Okay.
Okay, and then that cancels. But if you even had one less term, then you'd pick up a phase factor e to the, say, I phi, which would integrate to 0.
Couldn't you have integer multiple of that?
No, I don't think so. No, this is
right,
just the whole thing.
Okay.
This is integrating over, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Can I ask you some very stupid questions?
Sure, okay. Sure.
Yeah. What's that all meant?